Oh, death, won't you spare me over for another year? Joe, that's too depressing to put at the top of the show.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the studio, with his Mets hat, soldiering on even in these halcyon days of October without the Mets. It's Neil Payne. Hi, Neil.
You got to keep believing, Chad.
You got to believe in the first place, I hear, Neil, when it comes to Mets fandom. Neil, of course, a sports writer and editor at 538. And with us on the other line from a non-disclosed location in upstate New York, it's our project lead for Hot Takedown's John Starks Convention,
ooh,
Kate Fagan. Hi, Kate.
Yes! Hi, Chad. This is my favorite alternative intro that I've ever had.
Yeah, by day, ESPNW columnist. By night,
John Starks.
Decoupaging all sorts of John Starks memorabilia.
Organizer.
Are we going to brainstorm about this convention after the podcast?
Oh, yeah. That's a little bonus segment for a long time listener.
Right. If you're a Hot Takedown Plus member,
yeah,
you'll be able to hear.
That's the real premium content that people want to subscribe to. All right. So before we get going on today's show, actually, let me tell you what's on today's show. We're going to talk about baseball playoffs. And how the postseason has become reliever season in Major League Baseball. Then we're going to go to the WNBA, where there is a decisive Game 5 coming up later this week between the Sparks and Lynx. And we'll sort of check back in with what we said was that you should look out for with the WNBA playoffs, and especially what to look out for in that decisive Game 5. And then finally, hockey season has come back. Neil just snarled with approval. He's so excited. Neil Greenberg, a different Neil, will be with us to talk about hockey.
It's the Neil and Neil Hockey Show.
It's sort of a Canadian hockey special we're going to do. We're going to talk about the Canadians and the Maple Leafs in particular. All right. Now, Neil, can we talk about that freaking great documentary series that you launched in the Hot Takedown feed called Ahead of Their Time?
Sure.
I listened last
night. You're a
night.
Star, Neil. You're
I know.
A star.
Well, you
Neil?
Know, Drew Brees retweeted it. That was ooh, kind of the moment when I realized that that it had gotten big.
Neil, who would be the person whose retweet would send you over the edge if they tweeted about your great documentary series Ahead of Their Time?
You mean not Drew Brees?
Not Drew Brees.
I don't want to besmirch.
I mean, no, my point, like, in your, I've never
oh, like,
talked about
who
this.
Is?
In your athlete rankings, we know Kate's number one athlete. We know it's John Starks.
Who is my number one athlete? Gosh.
Dominique Wilkins? I'm just thinking your childhood, no?
Yeah, let's get back to it at the end of the
show. At the end of Dig. Stay tuned, listeners, to find out who Neil's
that's
favorite
quite a tease,
is.
Neil. That's
I know,
quite
right?
a tease.
It's going to be like, you know, if Kate's is John Starks, mine will be like Chris Childs or something. You know, it'll be like you know, some very disappointing, like, lesser
Charlie
player.
Charlie
Ward. Well, you know, Charlie Ward is a whole other subject we can talk about at some other point.
So for those who are not listening to Ahead of Their Time, it is in your Hot Takedown feed. It is a documentary series. Neil, maybe you can explain it a bit better very quickly.
Sure, yeah. So it's just a series where we focus on teams or coaches or players that kind of did something radical and they were kind of derided for it or not fully appreciated in the moment. And it turned out to be sort of, with the benefit of modern sabermetrics, they were kind of vindicated. It turns out what they were doing in the past actually was the statistically prescribed thing to do. So in our first episode, we looked at Lou Boudreau, who of course was the Cleveland Indians player manager that kind of devised the defensive shift against Ted Williams, the Ted Williams shift. And now, lo, these many years later, defensive shifts are out of control in baseball. And it can kind of be traced back to that. So it's kind of this example of a player that did something really, you know, revolutionary in the past and is now kind of getting their due, you know, with the advances in statistics that we've made.
And this week's episode coming up this Thursday is about the Russians.
The Russians were coming, and they were armed with statistics.
And sticks and pucks.
That's right.
It's about hockey.
Russians. Yeah, it's about hockey.
All right, so keep an ear out for that. Hot Takedown listeners, the next episode will be this Thursday and then weekly on Thursdays from here on out. And please let us know what you think. Email us at podcasts@538.com. All of your fanfic about Neil's voice is welcome. All right, on to baseball, where there are two championship series happening at the same time. In the ALCS, the Cleveland Indians are ahead 3-0 on the poor, poor Canadian Toronto Blue Jays.
It's just going to be one of those Canadian shows, I feel like.
In the NLCS, the Cubs and Dodgers are tied at 1 as of this taping after Clayton Kershaw's Herculean performance on, I have lost track of how many days rest. What, 2 days rest after 2 days rest before that, or something like that?
This is the closing performance he had. Yeah.
So let's start with the NL, because I want to use the AL to talk about relief pitching. In the NL, we came in saying that the Cubs were the best team in the majors, Kate, that they had 26% chance of winning the World Series. But they got beat by Kershaw and Kenley Jansen. And in the first game, it was also a very tight game. It was tight at least through the eighth inning. And I want to talk about some of the strategic decisions that Dave Roberts and Joe Bannon made inside of it. But I'm just wondering, what you've seen in that series, in the two games that we've seen, that may, convince you that 26% seemed right coming in and the Cubs are the best, or, after that one game where Kershaw and Jansen dominated, are the Cubs on the ropes, as they say?
Well, it doesn't feel like we really know anything yet. It feels like we've got one team, one game, one with their star, and then the second team won a game with their star in Kershaw. And at this point, the only reason, when I'm looking at the 538 numbers about probabilities to win the World Series, the Cubs has gone up, but now they're behind the Cleveland Indians, which to me is simply, Neil, correct me if I'm wrong, just a totally a facet of the fact that the Indians are so far ahead in their series, whereas we don't quite know who's staked in the victory ground yet, or has the lead, even not just in games with the Dodgers and Cubs, but also doesn't seem like that particular series there's been any identity solidified yet about what we can expect, because it's like the Cubs aren't hitting, their 1-5 hitters aren't hitting, certainly not the way we've seen them hit. And yet the Dodgers, they've already pitched Kershaw. They only seem to be winning games in which Kershaw appears, and the Cubs have such strong pitching.
Yeah, I think that's a great read of the current state of affairs, Kate, where, we have yet to see, first of all, we've seen Kershaw and we've seen, Jansen kind of come in and do his thing and close things out, which seems to be what the Dodgers are heavily relying on. We haven't even seen Jake Arrieta yet in this series. And so, I think we really haven't learned that much. If anything, we've learned more probably about the Cubs from the fact that they won by 4 runs in the first game than the Dodgers by winning by 1 run in the second game of the series. But again, we haven't seen enough to kind of reverse our priors, I wouldn't think, so far.
Okay, so with that said, look, can we go into the strategy in that game one? Because I thought it was so fascinating that Dave Roberts intentionally walked two Cubs batters in the eighth inning, to try and clear the pitcher's spot, because Aroldis Chapman was in the game throwing 102 miles an hour and eating up batters. And so Roberts said, you know what, I'd rather have Chapman out of the game, intentionally load the bases with 2 outs in a tie game at that time, I believe, and then I would have to face Chapman in the ninth. So, Neil, before we get to what that means for Chapman's effect on the game, I'm just wondering, loading the bases, adding two batters, in order to get rid of a great pitcher, is there any universe in which the probabilities match up there? Was that a crazy gamble, or was it maybe just actually a safer one than it appears?
I don't know, because, typically, you would maybe want to do that if you could kind of get to the pitcher and you knew the pitcher was going to be hitting, and that would happen earlier in a game. Obviously, at this point in the game, and this goes to kind of the mind games that you're talking about, of being able to knock the pitcher out and then be able to have the pinch hitter in, but just kind of in isolation, having a major league hitter coming up to the plate in that situation means that you're, you know, walking to get to that has reduced your odds of winning. And sure enough, you know, if we just look at, and again, none of this did happen in isolation because you do have that factor of Chapman. But, you know, when they intentionally walk Jason Hayward, that increased the Cubs' chances of winning by 2%. When they intentionally walked Chris Coughlin to load the bases, that increased the Cubs' chances of winning by 4%. And so it was kind of one of those things.
So 6% total?
Yeah, 6% total with those two moves.
And that doesn't take into account, though, who's pitching, right?
No, I mean, that doesn't take into account that it's Joe Blanton, I guess, although...
No, that Chapman was in the game, is my point.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's, you know, kind of independent of all that, that's kind of how those numbers shake out. And that speaks to the fact that intentionally walking is generally a pretty bad strategy. And you could kind of see, like, Dave Roberts has done this a few times where, like, the wheels turn with him and you can kind of see that happening. And he thinks that he's being so cute with it and that this was, like, a major coup to get Chapman out of the game. And then it's like, wait a minute, forget about this like meta game of, oh, look at us, we've knocked Chapman out of the game. How about Joe Blanton not serving up a meatball with the bases loaded to Miguel Montero? You know, it was almost like winning the meta game, but then losing the game itself, which is what's actually important.
So, Kate.
Well, yeah, because it feels like an emotional response. It feels like Chapman is a guy who you just emotionally are like, we don't want to have to face. But, like, is there any way to parse, like, you mentioned, like, the 6 percentage points increase in the Cubs' chance of winning as they're loading guys onto the bases? Like, is there any way to measure that against the percentage chances of winning with Chapman staying in the game and pitching to them?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure if you went through the involved calculations and tried to figure out, you know, well, how much is Chapman worth, first of all, and then look at the drop-off between that and the next available reliever. I don't know, had they used Rondon at that point, or was he warming up? No, they had to use Rondon. That's in the bottom of the ninth. So, you know, if you look at the difference between those two, it is, you know, a drop-off of probably, you know, a FIP. We've talked about FIP in the past, of like one whole point of FIP between the two, if you look at Fangraphs and their projections. Is that worth sort of the calculus of, you know, like, what should the Cubs have done?
What's a point of FIP worth in percentage points of win probability?
Right, exactly. And then you have to get into, like, really incredibly involved calculations there. And the other thing is, like,
on the fly, Neil.
You know, what are the Cubs going to do in that point? You know, they're not going to leave Chapman in to hit. And so, yeah, you know, he probably increased their chances of winning in excess of that 6 percentage points if you knock Chapman out. And then contingent on Blanton not giving up runs, granted with two outs but with the bases loaded in this situation, to give you a chance to capitalize on the fact that Chapman is out. So this is why it is an involved calculation. But at the end of the day,
right,
you know, I think that these things sort of, like, once you get to, like, the third and the fourth and the fifth layer of having to kind of figure out, well, okay, I did this and then they're going to do that and then I'm going to do this and it changes things this way, you're kind of overthinking things, I think.
Well, yeah, because it feels like if you go across sports, I'm not sure when you get into these kinds of layers and, like, mind games slash moves that go counter to what the sport is supposed to be about. So in baseball, when you're, like, loading up the bases like they were doing in the World Series, or putting people on the foul line in basketball, like, you can kind of explain it at certain points, but when you get really deep into it, and Neil, I'm not sure if this is statistically right or not, it feels like the rules of the game have existed in a way that allow for, like, the straight playing of the game to perhaps always give you the best statistical chance of winning. And when you get too deep in trying to, like, be counterintuitive to the game, you actually set yourself back.
Yeah, that's probably true. Like, you know, the reason why these kind of edge cases exist, like Shaq, you know, you're hacking him because he is such an outlier in a horrible direction as a free throw shooter that only in those edge cases does it make sense to do these weird things. And so maybe, you know, Chapman is an edge case, but it wasn't like the second best available reliever was, you know, so much different and so much worse. You know, what Chapman over Rondon is not like Shaq shooting free throws.
Real quick, Neil.
Right.
Sorry.
It's not like Chapman versus, like, high school reliever coming into the game.
So real quick, Neil, because this, then we have to move on to the AL, but this reminded me of something that was actually in ahead of their time, that documentary series we mentioned, the 2% doctrine that the Rays were all about, which is that if we can increase our chance of winning in 2% by 2% in various different places, mm-hmm. then that leads to more winning overall. But this is that kind of – that's an edge case too, right? Trying to increase your win by 2%. So how is a manager or a general manager or a player supposed to know when to try and go for a marginally higher chance of victory versus playing it safe?
Well, so first of all, I think that those kind of 2% advantages that, you know, Jonah Carey, for instance, talks about with the Rays in their kind of rise from mediocrity in the late 2000s, those are by nature adding up over the course of not just one season, but like multiple seasons, hundreds of games. Here we're talking about a situation where a couple games, you know, can make the difference between winning a series and losing a series. And so I just don't know if you even have enough of a sample to let, you know, the noise kind of be filtered out. And the other thing is, we don't actually know, and again, you know, this is us off the top of our head, maybe someone in the front office of the Dodgers has actually done this calculation, but you would actually have to game everything out and try to figure out if it actually even was a 2% advantage, because human intuition when it comes to things that are super complicated like this has a history of kind of not being the best estimator of what a 2% advantage actually is, or being able to identify it.
I love the idea of human intuition having a history that we can just like read a book of all the times human intuition went wrong.
Right.
All right, let's go to the ALCS, where the Indians sort of incredibly are up 3-0. This is a team whose starting rotation was hollowed out by injury coming in, and yet can't seem to lose. They sweep the Red Sox in 3 games in the ALDS. They are up 3-0 in the ALCS. Trevor Bauer is just—it's Halloween on the mound. There's blood dripping everywhere, and yet the bullpen comes in and pitches over 8 innings of relief, 8 1/3 of relief, allowing only 2 runs. The Indians win. Everything's going right for the Indians, including an incredible bullpen.
Right. I think that was kind of the quintessential Indians win. The one in Game 3 was like all postseason
bloody
long
bullpen filled.
Maybe bloody, yeah.
Saw that coming.
But this idea that they had a great starting rotation for most of the season, and then they lost a lot of the key members of that as the postseason neared. And that was one of the reasons why people, including our projection model at 538, thought, they probably don't have a very good chance of advancing deep into the playoffs. And so Terry Francona has done this amazing job of kind of assessing the situation, being like, look, we can't, if we're relying on our starters, especially starters other than Corey Kluber, we're probably not going to be able to go up against the other big teams in Major League Baseball. And so what do you do in that situation? If you can't have starters, why not just ask for more of your relievers, which is something that Sabermetrics has kind of been pushing for a long time. And so he has been kind of elevating it to this art form that I think stat heads everywhere are kind of looking at and being like, this is amazing. This is what we've been saying teams should and managers should do for years. Bringing in your closer Cody Allen in the 7th inning because it's a close game and you need, you know, some big outs, using Andrew Miller like the fireman of, you know, Raleigh Fingers era, you know, 70s baseball. Like, all of these things are things that stats have been kind of pushing for a long time, and this is one of the first cases I can ever remember of a manager actually kind of, you know, abiding by that and winning in the process. So I think it's like hats off to Francona and the Indians for what they've done so far.
Okay, Neil, if I can ask, and Chad, do you like how I always direct my questions at Neil?
Yeah, I've noticed, but you know what, Kate? Neil is so smart that I actually totally get it.
But are you like a secret stat man too, Chad?
I've been keeping it from you for 2 years, but I'm finally ready to admit that I know as much about.
Step out of the phone booth, Chad.
Yeah, so direct it at me, Kate. Just let me know what
All
the
right.
question is.
I'll direct it at you. Okay. So we talk about how, like, the postseason in baseball is random, right? More like we just don't have enough time to accumulate the number of games that will give us the best and most deserving champion, right?
Yes.
That's what we said. And so I guess I'm wondering, is like the postseason like a random sampling of a section of games, or are the variables that exist in the postseason so different that they affect the way the randomness falls?
Well, Kate, thanks for asking me that question. I'm happy to field it. Isn't it, the rules are a little different, not because the rules are different, but the way the game is played is different, is what I mean to be saying.
Right.
Which is that it's not a random, it's not a random selection of five games, for example, because there's no fifth starter is the first thing. And so the teams that have a shallower rotation are going to be favored. And that's why we thought the Indians were going to be in such worse shape, because the rotation was so shallow. Although you get to run Kluber out there, I guess, a few more times than usual. So there's that. And I think there's also what Neil's saying about the bullpen, which is that's going to change because you're pitching for a month and you know the end result. You don't need to conserve anything for the end of the season, you know, 6 months from now. You're able to sort of push guys a little more. And so I would think that while it's random, it's also distilled somehow. The talent of the teams are distilled because you can push people out there.
But then do the variables that you're pointing out, like bullpen being more of a factor, is there any sort of bounce back where then, like the Indians, right? You would have said the Indians would have been in a compromised position because perhaps they weren't built for the playoffs, and yet now they've made adjustments because of that. So is there like a bounce back then on those variables?
Right, but not all managers actually change their tactics for the postseason is part of the trick. And if they do, sometimes they overcompensate and they bring a new pitcher in every batter, which was the Tony La Russa and
Dave Roberts.
Yeah, I mean, so Neil, I've blabbed enough. Now bring the real knowledge.
No, that was good, Chad. I agree with what you said basically about, you know, shortening the rotation and, you know, managing the bullpen. I'm not sure how different it is versus functionally, you know, in a season, maybe your bullpen becomes, you know, shallower also in terms of you have like your guys and the people that you trust. And whereas, you know, in some random July game, you're going to maybe toss out, you know, one of your not star relievers in a clutch situation and see what happens, just to kind of get them some reps. Whereas in this case, you're using Andrew Miller and that's just how it is. And I should also say, Francona, this isn't like a postseason development, maybe the degree to which he's done it, but really ever since the Indians acquired Andrew Miller, there was a lot of speculation and he came at the trade deadline from the Yankees. There was some speculation that, oh, he is clearly a better pitcher than Cody Allen, which is true. He is going to come in and supplant Allen as the closer for the Indians, and then they're going to have this kind of Allen is the setup man, a.k.a. the eighth inning guy, and Miller is the ninth inning guy. Instead, and our former colleague Ben Lindbergh wrote about this during the season, they totally flipped it on its head even before the playoffs, where Francona was using Miller as this like seventh inning, you know, two inning kind of use him in a jam, but still have Cody Allen be the closer for the ninth, you know, kind of format. That is sabermetrically endorsed. He was doing that, you know, before the playoffs and to a certain extent, even before the level of injuries forced it to happen.
All right, let's leave it there. We did not have a chance to get to Rob Arthur's article, our colleague Rob Arthur's article, about how the postseason has become dominated by the reliever. It's on 538.com. We'll put a link on our show page. Okay, now let's hear a word from our sponsor. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by Blue Apron. Yes, that Blue Apron, the one that sends pre-packaged meals to your door and the one whose mission it is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron has partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States, and it can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S. And so there's really no excuse not to try it out. You're going to spend less than $10 per person for a delicious meal. Meals like crispy chicken Milanese with warm Brussels sprouts, celery, and potato salad, seared salmon with fall vegetable hash, and apple brown butter dressing. It's so delicious and mouthwatering, it's got me mispronouncing the word apple. So all you have to do is go to blueapron.com, check out this week's menu, and you're going to get your first three meals for free. With free shipping, blueapron.com/takedown. That's where you gotta go, and you're gonna get three meals for free with free shipping. You're gonna love how good it feels and tastes, and you're gonna love creating incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So do not wait. blueapron.com/takedown. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Okay, now let's move on to the WNBA, where, as we thought it might, it has come to the struggle between the Lynx and the Sparks, the Minnesota Lynx and the LA Sparks, has been titanic. It has all led to this.
So fitting.
To the WNBA Finals. Fitting. Why? Were there Cats and Sparks on the Titanic?
No, because we identified these teams early in the season as having these crazy records.
Okay. I thought you meant like something about the boat.
Because we're involved. Super smart.
Clearly.
Right. We knew this was happening.
It wasn't a Titanic joke.
Thank you.
Chad.
Thank you. I'm always looking for a Kate Winslet Leo joke. Game 5 is on Thursday. The series is tied 2-2. Maya Moore saved Minnesota's season, reads the ESPN headline, after a 31-point performance in Game 4. The series has sort of been a Maya Moore for the Lynx versus Candace Parker for the Sparks kind of battle. Which has been interesting because we have talked a lot on the show about Neko Ogumake leading into this, but Parker has sort of emerged as the sort of the star for the Sparks.
Reemerged,
absolutely. So, Kate, I was wondering if you could sort of outline for us Moore and Parker's legacy within WNBA and how there's maybe two different kind of players, especially because one has three titles and one has none.
They're so dramatically different, Moore and Parker, in terms of who they are off the court, which I think is somewhat reflected if you look at the numbers and their on-court performance. Because Moore tends to be, even if her numbers seem flashy, if you parachute back into them, she seems to, at the end of the night, just have done a lot of things, and you might not have been aware that it amounted to 31 points like she had in Game 4. Whereas Candace Parker has always, throughout WNBA, her career, kind of been a more in the limelight, flashy. That doesn't mean she's not productive, but it's been a very obvious pitch, Candace Parker, in terms of, like, at the end of the night, you know she's played well, you know she's scored, because it all seems apparent to you in the same way that she's kind of marketed herself, if we're trying to, like, parallel kind of who these two players are. And so as I've been watching the WNBA finals, I'm kind of landing in this place where I'm like, okay, the WNBA is 20 plus years old. Like, the style of play and the quality of play has evolved to the point where you can't really knock the quality of play. You can certainly knock the fact that the athleticism is not on par with what you are used to seeing in the NBA. But, like, the WNBA, if you look at it, they've got a Game 5 coming up with two superstars whose stories are so dramatically different. You've got Maya Moore, who's kind of so soft-spoken, doesn't engage very much on social media. She's a Christian. She's won two championships at UConn. She's going for back-to-back now with the Minnesota Lynx, versus Candace Parker, who's kind of been the poster child for the WNBA at times and has never won a WNBA championship. So you've got this good play with these very easy-to-consume storylines, and then you ask yourself the question, like, will that transcend to actually connect with the viewership who doesn't always watch the WNBA?
And I also just want to point out that, again, you know, framing it as Moore versus Parker is kind of the natural inclination, and these are kind of the faces of the franchises. Right. And then you have Ogumake.
And
actually,
I realized after I looked at the stats more closely, that framing that I just made was not so great.
Yeah, actually, you know, at least in the playoffs, playing better than Candace Parker in kind of every facet of the game. And so, you know, you kind of have that added element of trying to figure out, you know, who is the star? Is this really just like star on star, or is it something different from that? And so, you know, I think that what's, either way, no matter what happens at the after Game 5, you talked in the baseball segment, Kate, about, like, kind of knowing who the best team is. I'm not sure that this will tell us who the best team is or who the best star is or collection of stars, but I think we can be very certain that one of these two teams is the best, I guess, is kind of the way to put it, because they were so dominant and then they ended up in that. And I think that's, in some ways, refreshing. I don't know how you guys feel about, you know, sort of the drama of having the upsets being possible and taking out these two titanic teams, to use your phrase, Chad, earlier. is kind of taken away, and some of that is the playoff structure of the WNBA that kind of gives teams progressive buys to kind of ease their path if they had a great record. But then at the same time, we can be very sure that, you know, we're getting the very best in the finals themselves. So it's kind of a trade-off that you're having to make that seems to have worked out well, maybe, I guess.
Right. Well, you're right. You're right, Neil, in that we know for certain that one of these two teams is the best team in the WNBA. Now, if these two teams played like 20 times, perhaps if, let's say, the Lynx do win game five, perhaps the Sparks would win more of those matchups. But like, it would be so close. And the way the WNBA has restructured itself, and with the advantage of like those buys in the first round that we obviously give the top team such an advantage, like, it's unlikely in the WNBA that you're going to see some random team, as I think you're pointing out, like, swoop in and be the kind of underdog who can win it just because of the way the WNBA is structured. But like, I've been asking myself over the last week, like, because we've talked, we had Sue Bird on to talk about the lack and the dearth of analytics in the WNBA and how stats tell stories. Well, the WNBA this year kind of has both. Like, they started doing more advanced stats, and now they do have really good faces for those stats, right? You've got Candace Parker, you've got Maya Moore. If you want to understand, like, Candace Parker going for her first title, that's a pretty common story that can connect with everybody. I'm like, does the WNBA need more just storytelling, or do they need to just really invest in, like, doing more analytics stats? And maybe it's a matter of both, because you're still in the place with the WNBA where you're concerned, at least I'm concerned, that it's not transcending outside of the little bubble it's created for itself.
Yeah, and I think, to Neil's point earlier, that furthers, I think, a point you're making, Kate, you have these sort of dominant teams, and you have a playoff system that rewards those dominant teams, and so the WNBA can be selling excellence in a way that not all leagues can, which is that they can promise you and advertise that when you're going to watch the finals, you are going to see two great teams come and play. And that's a super compelling narrative to bring in to a casual sports fan who may not be playing, who may not be paying attention to the WNBA. Is, if you can tell me, it's the same thing with me watching the Euro soccer tournament or the World Cup, right? I might not be watching soccer all year round for male or female, but I know when I turn on the World Cup, I'm going to be seeing the best soccer there is to see, depending on how you feel about club versus national team distinctions, but put that aside. But, and I think that's something to be pushed for the WNBA as well.
Yeah. And I think, going to what you were talking about, storytelling, Kate, that in and of itself is such an easy narrative to jump on, that, you know, it is built in, and having that advantage almost should be used more. With the kind of narratives that we can tell within that, of, you know, having like hidden superstars who are having all-time great seasons, like, you know, to bring it back to Ogwumike, you know, mixing that in, I think maybe it's just a matter of packaging it and marketing it, and having people be able to kind of identify more that this isn't like the NBA. This isn't like, you know, especially not baseball or hockey, where your finalists are sort of almost picked out of a hat in some ways. This really is the matchup of the two dominant teams. Maybe that should be played up more.
Yeah, it should be played up more. And it feels like there should be more separation made by the WNBA, separating itself from the NBA, because we could be sitting here right now having the Golden State Warriors like beat the Cavaliers 4-1, which I think would have jump-started the discussion over the offseason about whether or not the NBA should follow suit and just have, just be done with conferences and have the best teams make the playoffs and have the best two teams in the finals, regardless of conference. But because the Cavaliers won, now you're like, oh, well, the Eastern Conference is fine. There's no problem in the NBA with ending up with the Western Conference Championship actually being the NBA Finals, although we might see that become an issue going forward. So because the Cavaliers won, it kind of hit a pause button on what the NBA should do between conferences. But the WNBA, as we mentioned, like, got rid of conferences when it came to the playoffs, and like, need to be selling themselves more as like this sprint with, like, they only have roster sizes of 11, and they have a short season, and they have a playoffs that, like, there's a level of excellence that happens all along the way, not just from roster size, but also to season size and also to how the finals and the playoffs are like performed and organized.
So, Kate, what you said about the NBA now maybe not needing to destroy this playoff system sort of remind me of how hard it is to fix things that are sort of fundamental to Congress and democracy, for example, when like the party in power never actually wants to change the way that they were elected into power and things like that. And it seems like there is never, it's so difficult when money is involved to find the right moment to change the infrastructure of how something works because there are vested interests in how that works. And what the opportunity that the WNBA has is that right now it has money involved, but not as much money as the male pro sports leagues. And so the time to get right and create the right setup and infrastructure for narrative is now. And so that's why these things matter quite a bit. Okay, let's leave it there and move on to our second sponsor. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by DollarShaveClub.com. You don't need to choose between price and quality to get an amazing and affordable shave. Just ask DollarShaveClub.com. Dollar Shave Club delivers amazing razors right to your door for a third of the price of what other razor corporations are going to charge you. You're never going to have to deal with the drugstore hassle of going to those weird locked away fortresses where the razors are sort of behind that plastic because the razors are going to be at your door. All you have to do is go to DollarShaveClub.com, pick a razor that works for you from their lineup of blades, and then that's it. That's all there is to it. So here's your chance to see why over 3 million members love Dollar Shave Club. Dollar Shave Club is so confident in the quality of all of their products that you can now get the first month of the club for free. All you have to do is pay shipping, and after that, it is just a few bucks a month after that first free month, that is. There is no long-term commitment, no hidden fees. Get yours at dollarshaveclub.com/takedown. That's dollarshaveclub.com/takedown. One note about this upcoming NHL segment, Kate had to step out, but she will be back for our significant digit. The NHL is back. It is time for hockey. It is Neil's favorite time, especially with the Mets no longer keeping his nights warm.
And so we're talking about this Neil.
Yes, that's true.
This is the most confusing segment.
On the other line, it's Neil Greenberg. Hi, Neil.
How you doing?
Doing well. Neil, what's the best bio for you these days? Washington Post fancy stats blog still, or are you up and moving?
No, I'm just still here working for the paper that Trump hates.
Excellent. You know, that's how a sports journalist does real hard-hitting political journalism. Happens to sign up with the right paper. All right. So, Neil, the NHL season is upon us. It's got some nice storylines coming to the year. I want to talk about two in particular, both of them involving Canada. Let's start with the Piqué Subban trade, which turned the hockey world upside down this summer. Piqué Subban, the very, very, very good defenseman, was traded to the Nashville Predators for the Predators captain, Shea Weber. Subban scored on the first shot on net he took as a member of the Predators.
Because of course he did.
Because of course he did. So ignore what you see, the early returns you've seen this year. Take us through. Subban is beloved by the fancy stats types. And remind us why that is, and then run us through the trade and why it may have been a major oversight by the Canadiens, if you agree with that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a pretty shocking trade for a number of reasons. The first is that it was a straight up defenseman for defenseman trade, and it really told us how each of the clubs looked at the defensive position. You had Shea Weber, who's more considered a stay at home defenseman, and then you have Piqué Subban, who's arguably the best two way defenseman in the league. Maybe you can put Erik Karlsson in that category. But you know, there's no doubting that Piqué Subban does a lot of things really, really well. And that is most often found in the offensive zone, as you mentioned before. He's no stranger to goal scoring. But it's interesting that Montreal would part ways with him. I mean, it was probably more of a chemistry personality trade than it was a hockey performance trade, because you look at how well the Montreal Canadiens were with Subban on the ice. I mean, the team scored 3.1 even strength goals per 60 minutes with him on the ice, 1.8 when he didn't skate on the ice. So, I mean, you're talking about a guy that has a lot of offensive output at even strength, which is arguably one of the most important factors you can possibly have in a defenseman. And he was traded away for a guy in Weber who, you know, this isn't to take away from Weber not being a good defenseman, but you look at how and where the National Hockey League is going, younger, faster, and more versatile, you know, phasing out the fighting component, phasing out the quote-unquote tough guy mentality, and even moving away in a sense away from block shots, because those indicate if you're blocking shots, you don't have the puck enough, and there's injury concerns. So it was a pretty weird trade from both an analytical and real hockey perspective.
Real quick about that change in the NHL, it reminds me a little bit of the change in basketball, which is becoming about people being able to play quote unquote out of position a bit more, or at least be able to switch positions and have sort of more malleable, free form rotations of players. Is there a connection to draw there about sort of the game growing up or evolving?
Yeah, and it's evolving ever since the lockout of 2005-2006, because the salary cap caused the youth movement. And instead of having these older veterans that were there for heart and grit, you were bringing in younger guys who were cheaper, but also, as I said, younger, faster. And you had also the youth movement spearheaded by guys like Alex Ovechkin and Sidney Crosby, who are very gifted offensively. I definitely think that you're on the right track there. And especially in terms of the blue liner position, you want more defensemen jumping up in the rush. You know, to use the local team as an example, the Washington Capitals, they had a stay-at-home defenseman in Carl Alsner. And when Barry Trotz came over to coach, he was very, very adamant about having Alsner jump into the rush more, create more offense, be more offensive. Same thing that we're seeing with Lars Eller, the third line center that they brought over recently. They keep telling him, shoot the puck more. And it's because when you get a shot on goal, literally anything can happen. I mean, there's a lot of luck involved in hockey and goal scoring. And that's why you want your team to put as many shots on net as you possibly can.
Now, is this directly related to some of the advanced stats things that we've talked about in the past, where, you know, now that teams are actually paying attention to that kind of thing and it's kind of proliferated through front offices, that maybe they are coaches are instructing the players to play in a style more conducive to that? Is there something to that idea?
Without a doubt, because what we found, what the analytics community found, I should say, is that
you're a member of that, Neil.
I am, yeah. But what was found, the research showed it was pretty clear. You want guys that can carry the puck into the offensive zone. There's two ways to get the puck into the offensive zone. There's carrying it in, which is what we see when a player has it on a stick and is weaving in and out of traffic. And then there's also the dump in, where they just launch the puck onto the other side of the net and hope that they have the speed to get there first and dig it out and then set up from that way. You're almost generating three times as many shot attempts when you carry the puck in than when you dump it in. So when you have these offensive-minded blue liners, they're typically guys that can carry the puck into the zone with control. And we saw that with, we're seeing that obviously with P.K. Subban. We see it with Erik Karlsson in Ottawa. We see it even with Mike Green in Detroit. You see it with the Ghost Bear in Philadelphia. I mean, all these young defensemen that you hear about, all these young defensemen that are on the highlight reels are guys that can carry the puck into the zone, and that's because it's much easier to not only generate puck possession but also maintain puck possession through the neutral zone, which may be the most important.
Sorry, real quick, you said the words ghost bear, I think, right?
Correct.
Is that a spectral apparition, or is that a human being?
Sorry, no. Shane Gotis Bear is a defender for the Philadelphia Flyers.
His nickname is the Ghost Bear. That is incredible.
Bear, yeah.
That might
an
make
awesome
me watch
nickname.
Hockey
yeah.
just like that. All right, Neil, you wanted to say something.
So Subban represents kind of the new age of player, and we talked about Weber being this sort of stay-at-home, maybe representative of the older style of what people wanted out of a defenseman. So is this almost like the outcome of this trade and maybe the outcome between the two teams in some ways, like a spiritual battle between the old school and the new school of how to build a team and philosophy? Of you know what makes a good player, but particularly makes a good defender.
Without a doubt. And that was probably one of the first things, you know, you put analytics aside. That's why when you don't normally see a straight up defenseman for defenseman trade. You certainly don't see it of the caliber that you see in Subban and Weber. And like I said, I mean, Weber is, he's only 31 years old. He certainly has been a dependable defenseman in the NHL for a long, long time. But you don't make that sacrifice in today's NHL. You don't sacrifice a guy that adds little to the scoreboard in lieu of a guy that can literally generate his own points out of thin air.
Interesting. I feel like Nashville might be my team this year in the NHL. So let's move on.
They've got those mustard-colored uniforms, which are always classy and stylish.
I love a good mustard in my sweater choices. So let's talk about Austin Matthews up in Toronto. This is a 19-year-old kid who scored 4 goals in his debut. Did people see this coming, Neil, or was this sort of just this fluke that put this guy on the map all of a sudden?
Well, look, you score 4 goals in a game, it's fluky. I mean, there's no way around it. But he was also the number one overall pick, so you certainly thought that he would have some decent game, right? I mean, that's certainly for sure. But the way that the fact that it happened in the debut and the fact that it's happening in Toronto and the fact that he was on the third line maybe for like 2 shifts before he was moved to a top line player and got all these endorsement deals and everything like that. I mean, we're seeing a resurgence, I think, in Toronto that the fans there and the sport especially has been waiting for quite a long time. I mean, Toronto, to its credit, has built an analytics department almost from scratch. They've gotten some of the best and brightest minds, both in the front office but also surrounding, to craft this. Not that was the driver to get the number one pick in Austin Matthews, but he's certainly spearheading a youth movement right now.
Okay, so let's now we talked about Montreal and Toronto. Can we just give the state of Canada going into this season, which has already started, but we ended last season, I think at some point talked in the playoffs about how no Canadian team made the playoffs and how tragic that was for a country that prides itself on its hockey prowess. Neil, as you look at the Vegas odds, it doesn't look good for Canadian teams.
No.
The highest one is 9th, and there are 8 Americans.
Is that Montreal?
Montreal is 9th, correct?
Yeah.
And there are 8 Americans ahead. So what's a Canadian got to do to get a win in the playoffs?
Well, they're going through a lull. There's no doubt about that. I do think Montreal will probably be the only playoff team among the Canadian teams. I think I had them projected for 99 points. I'm not sure what the Vegas over-under was at this point. But I do think, though, that's saying something, right? Because that's with the trade of Subban. They probably would have been a lot better if they had Subban and obviously a healthy Carey Price. I think Calgary Flames might get close. They were dead last in the NHL for save percentage last year. They signed Brian Elliott, a goaltender from the Blues. But by and large, I'm not real bullish on the Canadian teams in both the short term and the intermediate term.
All right. Neil Greenberg of the Washington Post, thanks for that little preview. I'm sure we'll have you back when some other rookie scores 4 goals to talk about all that. Thanks, Neil.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Okay, now let's move on to Sig Dig when we get a significant digit, a telling number from the world of sports. This week, folks, I'm bringing the Sig Dig.
Woo! Yay.
Courtesy of our producer, Joe Sykes, who gave it to me. But our Sig Dig this week is 103 miles per hour. That is the speed of a pitch thrown by Shohei Ohtani, a member of the Nippon Ham Fighters, the Hokkaido Nippon Ham Fighters, a great name for a baseball team. This Ohtani character is storming his way through the Japanese baseball playoffs. He's a starting pitcher, 22 years old, who came in for a save, and because he was coming through for a save, was liberated and could throw 100.
The shackles were off, Chad.
He's Donald. He liberated and threw 103 miles per hour fastball, 2 fastballs at 103 miles per hour, breaking the record in the league for the fastest ball ever thrown. The record, he owned the old record of 164 kilometers per hour. It's now 165 kilometers per hour. He also started as a designated hitter in three games. He didn't pitch. This guy just seems to be everything.
Yeah, it's pretty insane because in addition to – so you got the 103. That's the Cy Dig. If not for the 103, maybe the Cy Dig would be 1.86, which is his ERA. 1.86. That's pretty crazy. And also – oh, you know, by the way, he also has a 1,004 OPS. he's hitting .322, has 22 home runs, a .416 on-base percentage, and a .588 slugging percentage. It's just nuts. Like, the dude is good at pretty much everything, it looks like. And he's only 21.
And 22. He also 22. Has a what million-dollar contract in Major League
totally.
Baseball coming up?
So we're getting all this from Ben Lindbergh's piece on the Ringer, all these details. And, Kate, that made me think of that, too. A, an NL team better pick him up given his batting. B,
Madison Bumgarner to the like 10th power.
Right. There are
power.
Are rumors, I think, that an international draft is coming. I don't think it's been confirmed yet, but that's
all, something they're fighting for.
Yeah,
sure.
that the signing, what's it called? The posting fee, is that what it's
right.
called? Is going to go away from baseball because it's become so corrupt, and instead you're going to get to a draft that's going to take some money out of the players' hands, but maybe make it a bit more official. But Kate, to your point, I mean, this guy, he's got some money headed his way for sure.
He should be a New York Met.
You know, the Mets.
Mets have such a great history with Japanese players too. You know, Shinjo and Matsui, Kazuo, not Hideki.
Do you remember Hideo Nomo's pitch counter clock, where it would take him 30 seconds to throw a pitch? Anyway, all right, that will do it for this week's show. Check out Ben Lindbergh's piece on The Ringer about Shohei Ohtani if you're interested in people throwing balls very fast. Kate Fagan. How's that convention coming? How's that John Starks convention?
We've got a bunch of panels we're
Good.
Setting up.
Yeah.
So if you want to moderate one, and Neil, I think you should just host an entire sort of TED Talk like on John Starks.
About Starks. Starks
that's
Con.
Actually, you know what? That's
Starks
a good,
Con 2016.
That's a good video series for Neil where we get a stage for him and make it
a mock
TED Talk, but a sabermetric analysis of someone's career.
I'd do that.
I think that's it.
Yes.
Yeah, let's talk to Tony about that. All right. So thanks, Kate. Thank you, Neil. Neil, who's your favorite athlete?
Yeah,
you've
still
had the whole show.
I still have
oh,
not
come,
come to a conclusion.
All right,
but
by
I've written
next week,
things.
That's your homework assignment.
Right. I've written things about underrated players.
I don't care
in the
about
past.
Underrated.
No, just
I care
your
about
favorite.
Your,
who's
yeah.
in your heart?
Talk
who's
to us
in
about
your heart?
Oh, my
once, Neil.
God.
Remove your intellect from it.
I'm going to go with Marshall Faulk.
Marshall?
I'm not that sure that you really believe in who you just said.
Yeah,
it didn't
week,
feel
next
passionate.
Week. I agree.
Didn't feel passionate.
I'm gonna go
I dug
with
deep
this
for
person
that.
Who I thought of just now.
I dug deep
Neil,
for that.
Neil, next
I
week.
I love Lamp.
Oh my God.
Next week, I want and listeners email who Neil's favorite.
I don't understand. So what's wrong with Marshall Faulk?
The way you
well,
said
the fact
the
that
name.
It took you that long to come up with it doesn't really resonate with like passion go, and like child adoration.
Right. Go back to your old posters, your old trading cards, Neil.
Okay.
There's got to be somebody in some basement box somewhere that we.
I would say, okay, here we go. Mike Modano of the Dallas Stars. Hockey was, like I've said many times, hockey was my kind of go-to sport when I was a child. And so, yeah, Mike Modano just spoke to me. I had many cards of his and was, you know, rooted for the Dallas Stars heavily when they won the Cup. With Brett Hull's questionable foot in the crease goal on Dominic Hasek in 1999.
I could see you with this Mike Modano mullet. I could see you.
I feel better about that.
Well, Mike Modano right. was a very good looking man, so I'll take that as a compliment, Chad.
All right, so that'll do it for this week's show. As I've said before, I've already thanked my two co-hosts. What else do I say at the end of the show here? We couldn't do the show without our producer, Joe Sykes. Our podcast. Our favorite podcast player is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance from Tony Chow, Jorge Estrada, and Jonathan Yales. And before I give you all the rest of the boilerplate, remember to check out Ahead of Their Time. It's already in your feed. You don't even have to subscribe to it. You are already subscribed if you subscribe to Hot Takedown, which you should do in your favorite podcasting app. But it's there. It's ready. Ahead of Their Time, it's Neil's voice for a half hour. Cannot speak highly enough.
Yeah, who doesn't want to hear that?
What a great treat it is to brush your teeth. At the end of a hard day's work, listen to Neil and think, you know what? I'm going to floss because I want to hear Neil for an extra 120 seconds. Email us at podcast@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think about Hot Takedown, Ahead of Their Time, or whatever else is on your mind. Find us in your favorite podcasting app. I already told you to do that. Leave a review. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I am Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.